Good morning. It wasn't a great morning in my household this morning. My wife is out of town for a week. And if you saw me with my four children the past few days, Chief Performance Officer would not be what would come to mind as a title. I was actually speaking a couple of weeks ago, and I had the four little monsters, kids, with me. And my youngest, who's eight, walked up to me beforehand, just as I was about to speak, and said, "Hey, Dad, keep your chin up so you only have one." So I'm going to do my best job today, but nothing like the honest feedback of little kids. So I thought maybe I'd start with why this sort of midlife crisis, if you will, because I've been, as Sally Ann said, in the private sector, and this is my first attempt at being in the public sector, and it's quite a change. And I'm very, very excited about that change. So why did that happen? I actually grew up here and have spent almost my whole adult life here. And as a result, I grew up with friends whose parents served in or around government and with neighbors and all the rest. So I always thought, hey, what they do is pretty important and meaningful, and I'd like to do that someday. So I always had that as a backdrop. I'm a big believer in the president and this administration, and I think we would all agree that it's a pivotal time in our country's history. And then it was the job itself, the job of Chief Performance Officer and Deputy Director for Management at OMB, fits fairly well with some of the experiences I had in the private sector at the Advisory Board and Corporate Executive Board, two firms that do, as Sally Ann said, benchmarking and best practices for organizations around the world, primarily for-profit organizations, but focus on effectiveness and efficiency and service quality. So it's bottom line is it's an honor of a lifetime to be part of this at this point in time and to join all of you who are directly or indirectly serving the American people. And I'm excited to be on this journey with you. I am extremely aware that I am the new guy in the room. When I look around, there's probably, 500, 1,000 people, years of experience in this room serving the government directly and indirectly. And last week, I celebrated my 100th day. So I'm the rookie. And what I would like to share today are my early thoughts or my instincts on where we might head. But I'm very aware that I have a lot to learn. So these are early insights. Inevitably, we will iterate together on this and a lot will change. Let me give you sort of a one-minute overview of where this is headed. The people who serve in government know what needs to get done. And I think they have, or we have, a pretty good sense of what stands in the way. And it's a similar situation to what I saw in the private sector, that success and failure are less a function of vision or strategy and more a function of execution. That without strong execution, even the very best strategies will fail. So the bottom line being that execution and implementation matter most, and I believe that this is where we should focus our energy, on freeing up the people who serve serving government, who are involved in government, to get things done for the American people. We should focus on building a culture of results in government. And that's what I want to spend the next 30 minutes or so talking about how we might go about doing this. As I said earlier, I've been here almost my whole life, but until a few months ago, I'd spent all of my time in the other Washington, the private sector. And as I said, zero public sector experience. And I have a huge appreciation for how different the public sector is from the private sector. I'm hoping there's some transferable lessons. But at the same time, I want to make it very clear that I'm extremely humble about how different the situation is and therefore how much I need to learn. So my approach as a result has been to go on a listening tour. I've gone about across government the last 100 days or so, asking people what's working, what's not working, what do we do or how do we improve performance, and broadly, what keeps you up at night. So today is a roll-up of those observations from that 100-day listening tour. Let me start with the first observation is I believe there's urgency around our shared agenda of improving the efficiency and effectiveness of government. First slide, please. On the left-hand side here, you can see that we start at the bottom of a pretty steep curve. This is the deficit. And as we all know, it's expected to balloon in the coming years. And this will put pressure on all of us to manage more efficiently, to get more out of existing resources. Right-hand side, at the same time, our citizens, our customers, are not satisfied with how we're performing. After a period of relative stability, there's been a sharp rise in dissatisfaction. And we risk losing the people's trust that we can deliver them good results. The bottom line is those financial pressures, the deficit, coupled with this rising dissatisfaction, I believe creates urgency. So I don't think this is a period of business as usual or incremental change, but rather a period requiring significant change. Here's what the president said in his inaugural speech. Next slide, please. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that's dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will end. And those of us who manage the public's dollars will be held to account to spend wisely, reform bad habits, and do our business in the light of day. Because only then can we restore the vital trust between a people and their government. This is a clear challenge for all of us. How do we improve the quality of our services in a resource-constrained environment? How do we do more for less? My second observation makes me very optimistic about what we can do. The people who work in and around government are very talented and very committed. Next slide, please. This slide is reflective of that level or this high level of talent and commitment. It's a collection of success stories from the Kennedy School and for the Partnership for Public Service. This is just a handful of hundreds of stories. Individuals and teams of government employees and contractors doing great things for the American people across all corners of government. Let me briefly describe two stories. Upper left-hand side, the vessel tracking technology at DOT. Post 9/11, we were very worried about our ability to track vessels around the globe. Experts thought it would take years and hundreds of millions of dollars to come up with a comprehensive system. The team at DOT thought otherwise. They creatively combined existing systems and launched a new system in less than 1 year at a very modest cost. But top right-hand side, the Homelessness Partner Network. This is at HUD, and it's the work of an interagency council on homelessness. It enlisted 850 local partners across the country to create 43,000 affordable homes. The basic premise here is it's actually less expensive to put a family in a home than it is in a shelter. And this program has been a big success and an impact on tens of thousands of families across the country. These are real stories of team heroics getting things done for the American people. And I think that these stories are told, but not told often enough. And it's the result of hard work and talent. And we need to make sure we celebrate these stories. My third observation is, while a lot of great things are happening, a lot stands in the way of talented and committed people to getting even more done. Next slide, please. This is perhaps the strongest message that I heard across my 100-day listening tour. People know what needs to be done, but there are too many barriers to getting it done. The four that I hear most often are shown on this slide. The first is senior leader focus. Political appointees traditionally focus on policy, not management or implementation. They tend to turn over every 18 months, maybe 2 years. And this turnover combined with this lack of focus has an impact on career managers that they feel every day. Next, failed IT. We have outdated systems across government. Too many processes remain paper-based. And we have a history of failed attempts to upgrade our IT. Third, contracting. It's a cumbersome process. It's slow. And we don't take advantage of our position as the world's largest purchaser. Finally, hiring. It's very difficult to compete for talent when it takes almost a half a year to hire someone. So let me try to pull this all together. I'm Jane in a large agency with significant management responsibility. I've been given an important initiative to run. Sounds exciting, sounds good. Too bad my boss isn't focused on what I'm doing. He's focused on trying to get his signature policy passed. That's okay, I'll drive it myself. But wait, my IT, which has driven most of the productivity gain in the private sector across the last decade, my IT is dysfunctional. Darn. Well, I'll contract out the hard stuff to the private sector. That's a good instinct, but it'll take years to get done, and likely by the time it's done, it'll be outdated or obsolete. Now what? I'll hire some really smart people and plow through. Great. See you in 6 months after all the other great candidates take good jobs elsewhere. Clearly exaggerating, but you get a sense of what I call the quadruple whammy. Some of these challenges are unique to the government, but I think we can learn from large corporations that have focused on execution. Let's take a look at IBM under Lou Gerstner. Next slide, please. When Gerstner arrived at IBM, it was one of the largest, most bureaucratic companies in the world. However, the bad news was that it was getting smaller fast. It was being clobbered by more nimble, more innovative competitors. In fact, its market share had been cut in half. It was bleeding cash, $8 billion loss in 1993. Gerstner arrived and initiated a series of actions. First, he created urgency. He went around IBM and told people that the situation was dire, that if IBM didn't change, it would go out of business. Second, he exposed absurdities. There was an infamous policy, a 60-page memo written to the executive assistant of a senior executive about what the executive's preferred chewing gum was and how to set the clocks in the executive's office. He pushed very hard against a culture of studying things to death, and instead he started to recognize and reward people for getting things done fast. He terminated several billion-dollar-plus investments because they were either behind schedule, draining cash, or doomed for failure. All of these actions began to transform IBM's culture from slow and bureaucratic to getting things done. Gerstner summarized his approach for fixing IBM as it was all about execution. In fact, he said, the last thing IBM needed was a grand new vision. So what were the bottom line results? 2001, a complete reversal, an $8 billion profit, not loss, a $16 billion swing. The business guru Michael Hammer called it the single greatest turnaround in modern business history. Execution is not just important at IBM. In fact, I believe it's the most important driver of value across the whole of the private sector. Next slide, please. This data comes from stock market analysts. On the left-hand side, across the private sector, execution is the number one factor for determining a company's value, more important than the quality of the strategy or even the credibility of the management team. On the right-hand side, execution failures are the single greatest risk for companies. But as big as execution is in business, I think it's even more important and more challenging in government. This is my major conclusion from these first 100 days. This is where we should focus our energy, freeing up the people serving government to get things done for the American people. And I propose that this be my main mission as Chief Performance Officer, focusing on building a culture of results across government. Let's now turn to how we might get this done. Next slide, please. What do we do to build this culture? I think there are two large chunks. The first is to overcome the implementation hurdles that we talked about, IT, contracting, hiring. We address this on the left-hand side, building foundational capabilities to free you up to get stuff done. Right-hand side is the second chunk. It's how do we install a sustainable implementation culture? Let's start with building the foundational capabilities and those dreaded two letters, IT. Next slide, please. This is IT, the greatest gap that I've seen between my private sector experience and the public sector. IT has been at the center of the productivity gains and the quality improvements in the private sector across the last decade or two. And I believe that with a few exceptions, the government has missed most of these gains. On the left-hand side, the well-known Census Bureau handheld device failure. $600 million of wasted effort when it was determined that the handheld would not be ready in time to be used for the 2010 census. On the right-hand side, for those of you who are federal employees, this is the data storage system for your retirement records. These records are maintained manually. They're stored in Boyers, Pennsylvania, in a cave. It actually is a cave. It reminds me of that famous last scene at the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Not surprisingly, GAO reports that, quote, attracting qualified personnel to operate and maintain the antiquated retirement system is challenging. Across government, this failure to automate is not for a lack of trying. We actually spend more than $70 billion a year on IT. And there are some success stories. But we have way too many failed projects that run over budget, that are years late on delivery, or never delivered the promised results. We need to fix large-scale IT implementation, from spec development to procurement to project management. Speed is central here. We all know technology moves very fast. Given our processes and our policies, we move too slow. We're falling further and further behind. I am deeply committed to closing this technology gap. The President appointed the first federal CTO and the first federal CIO to help coordinate our efforts. We will beef up our project management capabilities, we'll work with Congress to speed up our processes, and we will take advantage of new technologies that are cheaper and faster. Now let me turn to contracting. Next slide, please. As you know, we're the world's largest purchaser, over $500 billion a year. This has doubled across the last 8 years. I believe we need to remake how we do contracting. We need to make processes work better. We need to be more responsive and faster, and we need to save money. In March, the President put a stake in the ground that we'd save $40 billion off of that $500 billion base. Contracting divides into two broad categories: more commodity-like products and services, and more complex purchases. For commodity-like purchases, because we are so siloed, we oftentimes don't pool our purchasing power. Because we require so much compliance, even though we're large, we tend to be more expensive to serve. Take the case of package delivery on the right-hand side. Most companies and other organizations consolidated to one overnight delivery provider 10, 15 years ago. Yet the government just started this effort in 2005, which is good, better late than never. And we've made some progress, 20% lower prices. There are hundreds of opportunities for us to lower our costs through strategic sourcing. As for the more complex products and services, that second category of contracting, we need better management and coordination from project spec to negotiation to contract management all the way through completion. We need to gather better information on our experiences in those different silos and share it across. The government also needs to invest in the acquisition workforce. While we more than doubled, as you see on the left-hand side, our contracting, we didn't invest much in the workforce. The workforce stayed about flat. We need to invest in the size of that workforce and the capabilities. I do appreciate that contracting in the federal government is different than in the private sector. We need to consider factors beyond just price and delivery, and our contracting policies must reflect the diversity of our interests. That said, our contracting infrastructure was built for a different era. We need to catch up, and we will. Next slide, please. Does anyone have any idea what this is? It is a, close, all that's close, it's a map. It's a map of the hiring process for the Federal Student Aid Office. I had to put it in 10-point font to get it on the screen. It's a 6-person job, count the legs, to hold up the map. It's 114 steps and 45 handoffs. FSA is not the exception. In fact, it's right in the middle of the pack with an average hiring time of about 150 days. I spent a lot of time in the private sector recruiting. It was probably, when I was CEO, at least a quarter of my job. And my experience is that the best talent does not loiter for 5 months. It finds another home. FSA has actually made progress here. This is a few months old. They've streamlined it by 50%. And we are working, OPM, John Barry, and I, and others are working across agencies to speed up hiring and to attract the top talent. However, the hiring problem is not just the slow process. It's also the employment proposition itself. The president has set out the aspiration, we need to make government service cool again. To do this, I believe we need to invest more in our people, including in their training and in their development. We need to better understand the needs of the broader workforce and the needs of our managers. What tools do we need to develop? What do we need to do to ensure a continued high level of engagement? We will make these necessary investments. That brings me to an end, brings us to the end of our first area of focus. Next slide, please. This left-hand side, we've now talked about all three areas where we want to build foundational government capabilities. This will set us up for significant performance improvements by removing those barriers and making those processes faster and better. More execution will occur. However, I believe that this alone is not sufficient. We need to focus on how we make results and execution more likely to occur, or how we install a sustainable implementation approach. There's been a lot of management literature on this topic. Famous CEOs, Larry Bossidy and Jack Welch, have written books. The major management consulting firms have all weighed in, and the academics have contributed. Next slide, please. In my own management experience and in this literature, there's a fundamental tension that people observe or organizations face between focus and participation. Typically, organizations choose between the top left, command and control, or the bottom right, a more enfranchising, less focused approach. The problem of the top left is that it's hard to tap into people's intrinsic motivation. Tracking and grading become the primary tools. Some might characterize the last administration's approach as largely this top left box. The danger of the bottom right, letting a thousand flowers bloom, is that you have broad engagement but not enough direction. You tend to pick the low-hanging fruit and not address the larger scale systemic reforms that are required. This might capture some of the Gore-led efforts under Clinton. Given the importance and the urgency of what we need to get done, I believe we can't accept this trade-off. Next slide, please. And I believe we can break it. We can break the trade-off by embracing a new execution approach made possible by new technologies. It's the top right box, what I'm calling focused collaboration. This is happening in leading-edge private companies and other organizations. The new approach has four core principles: prioritization, transparency, engagement, and rapid results. And I'm convinced that if we focus on these four core principles, we can break the traditional trade-off. These principles, these four principles, have been guiding our early efforts. And what I thought I'd do is I'd bring each one to life using examples of work that we currently have underway. Next slide, please. Let me start with prioritization. I believe that to focus on everything is to focus on nothing. Naming priorities with clarity is the first principle of execution. We've jump-started prioritization in the form of high-priority performance goals. We've asked each agency's senior team to identify their handful of most important management goals, anywhere from 3 at a smaller agency to no more than 8 at a larger department. We are really excited about what's happening here. The goal-setting conversations are engaged at the right level. Cabinet secretaries and deputy secretaries fully scrubbed in on what the goals should be, making the appropriate trade-offs, and thinking through how they're going to accomplish these management, not policy, goals. I believe this is the first step in overcoming that other barrier that we talked about, senior focus. Let's take a look at a specific example. It's the bottom part of the slide. From the Interior Department, their goal is, or one of their goals, is to increase the potential for production and transmission of renewable energy resources on interior-managed areas by 9,000 megawatts by 2011. The most important thing about this goal is its source. These goals are owned by the agency, not by OMB or some other party. Second, they are very straightforward. Brief outcome-based statements of what the agency wants to achieve. Third, they're focused on important priorities that need to be done in order to achieve the agency's mission. Fourth, they move out of the stovepipe. They are integrated with agencies that share the same objective. In this case, Commerce, DOD, DOE, and EPA. Fifth, they're quantifiable. We will know if we achieve them or not. We can track our progress against the goal. Finally, the time frame is a time frame that we can actually relate to. We'll get stuff done in a year or two, or we'll know if we haven't. We are very committed to helping agencies achieve these goals. Let me move next to transparency, which I believe serves two purposes. First, it holds our feet to the fire. Second, it engages the best minds to get us to the best solution. Next slide, please. Have any of you had a chance to see the IT dashboard? A couple of folks. The president has. Here he is reviewing it. The IT dashboard covers all the major IT investments across the federal government. You can see in the top right box here, well, you have to have pretty good vision to see it, that for every project, we can now review real-time its cost performance versus its original budget, how it's doing on its timeliness, where is it relative to the milestones that were set out in its original schedule, and overall, how does the agency CIO assess the project? The dashboard was launched in June, and I think it's a great example of using technology to put information online for decision makers and the public, information that will actually be used to make decisions. You see this at the VA. The VA actually, as a result of the dashboard, the senior team decided to put 45 IT projects on hold to decide whether these investments are on track and should be continued, whether there should be a mid-course correction, or whether the project should be terminated altogether. Used, that's the key word here. Measurement that is used. The dashboard, I think, represents measurement that is actually used by senior decision makers to drive decisions. We have lots of measurement activities across the government, but I'm struck by how often they're compliance exercises or produce paper as opposed to decisions. we plan to roll out these style dashboards across government. Let me take another look at transparency. Here, where transparency unleashed creativity, and this goes beyond the four walls of government. Next slide, please. Left-hand side, this is a screenshot from data.gov. The purpose of this site is to put all the available information that government has in a single place so that citizens and others can access it to it, get access to it easily. As of a week or so ago, there were 118,000 data sets on the site, from global earthquake frequency to crime statistics to toxic chemical data. Giving citizens access to this data sparks innovation and creates valuable applications. Take the example of flyontime.us. This is a new resource for all of us who do a fair amount of travel. And it combines flight and weather information from data.gov with citizens reported data on the length of security lines. So that's real-time data. And that allows by combining those three sources, you can get a complete estimate of the travel time from one airport to another. This application was only made possible by data.gov. And it's a great new resource for all of us, which was developed at no incremental cost to taxpayers. So we've talked about the principles of prioritization and transparency. Next, let's turn to engagement. Next slide, please. This is our third principle. Engagement improves the quality of innovation. It also enfranchises stakeholders whose buy-in is needed to overcome the implementation hurdles we discuss. It's a principal hallmark of this administration that by inviting people to be part of the process, it makes the process better. And that's just what the VA is doing with its innovation initiative. The VA disability claims process is very slow, and that leads to significant backlogs and poor customer service. The innovation initiative recognizes that many, or arguably most, of the best ideas in how you improve this situation, reduce the backlogs, and get better customer service, comes from frontline workers. As you can see on the screen, individuals on the front line can submit ideas, they can rate or discuss the ideas of others, and they can take action to improve those ideas. There's been lots of participation, 3,000 ideas, 6,000 comments, 28,000 votes cast. The best ideas will be selected soon. There's a fund to pilot and implement those ideas, and the winners will receive national attention, recognition. These types of idea centers are sprouting up all over government. The Idea Lab at CDC, Aristotle at DOD, we launched save.gov a few weeks ago. We have 38,000 submissions to save.gov on ideas on how we can save costs and improve the efficiency and effectiveness of our services across government. I believe these are great tools for engaging individuals across the government and spurring innovation. The last principle is rapid results. This is starting with the answer first and then working back to how do you get it done. This challenges us to avoid traditional process ruts, and I think it also provides momentum for the larger, more systemic reform efforts. Let me bring this to life with a recent example from the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service. This is the old INS. Next slide, please. The application process here is notoriously slow and opaque. In fact, for an applicant to know where they stand in the process, traditionally you'd have to engage a lawyer who would most likely bill you for making a bunch of phone calls and getting back to you a few weeks later with some type of response as to where you stood. Late June, the president charged Secretary Napolitano and the team at USCIS to stand up a new communication system within 90 days. Our team helped out. Federal CIO Vivek Kundra and Anish Chopra, who's the CTO, supported the team's effort. That's a tall order, a new communication system in 90 days, but there's nothing like a deadline. We know that every April 15th. So not surprisingly, on September 24th, which was 90 days to the day when the president had made the original challenge, the site went live. This screenshot, although it's probably hard to read in the back of the room, shows how it's now easy for an applicant to see where they are in the process. It's the same technology, if you will, of when you ship a FedEx package. You can go online at any point and know where it is and when it's going to land at its intended destination. An applicant has that type of clarity and visibility into the process. They can see where they are and how long, on average, at that processing center it takes to complete that process step. They can also, the applicant can also benchmark how they're doing in the process, how long it is taking versus other applicants. This site makes a difference for hundreds of thousands of people. And these kind of results matter. According to Gallup, the best way to change someone's impression of the government is when that individual is in direct contact with the government. When someone has a good interaction, they're much more likely to have a favorable view. As the president has said, we owe it to our citizens not just to spend their money well, but to restore their trust. The USCIS team embraced rapid results to find faster, cheaper, and smarter solutions to their problems. That brings us to the end of the examples of our core principles: prioritization, transparency, engagement, and rapid results. Let me lift up here and transition from my first 100 days of observations to give you a sense of the direction we might head. Next slide, please. I believe that the changes that we have discussed, removing barriers, building core capabilities, and changing the culture, will combine to have a significant positive impact on our overall performance. However, I do not believe that these changes alone are sufficient. Based on the conversations I've had with many of you and your peers throughout the government, I believe there's also a personal change component to this, that in order to build the future we all aspire to, we will need to change our personal behaviors. Let me start with me and my team. This is the team at OMB. Next slide, please. We are moving from command and control to focused collaboration. Let me highlight some of the changes that we have underway at OMB. On the left hand of the slide, we are going to move from OMB setting priorities to the agency setting the priorities, from oversight to partnership, from shipping reams of guidance to two-way dialogue around how we achieve the desired outcome, from transparency not just for accountability but for idea flow and to find the best practices and share them broadly, from ad hoc engagement of stakeholders such as Congress to regular communication. That's a sense of the change that we have underway for me and my team at OMB. I'm sure we will mess up and we'll slip into old patterns. So call us out on that, but I'm committed to you that we will serve you differently than we have in the past. What could this mean for you going forward? Next slide, please. What I've attempted to do here is to list a few questions that you might ask yourself as you think through how this change might impact you. What can I do in the next 6 months that will most advance our mission and build citizen faith in government? How do we improve our systems? How, for example, might we expand the way people think about risk from that around their own individual areas to strategic risk across functional areas or department? What can I do to make sure everyone on my team understands the importance of their contribution to our shared goals? Who's doing something great that I can recognize as an example for others? In closing, let me return to that team at USCIS that stood up the website in 90 days. Next slide, please. This team worked 24/7 for 90 days. They threw out old ways of doing business. They embraced new technologies and they developed new ways of working together. You can see the picture of the team celebrating with Secretary Napolitano. This is a quote from the team leader. "Within a short window, we created something meaningful and impactful and surprised ourselves. Through teamwork, collaboration, and perseverance, anything is possible." As I talk to these team members and reflect on what happened here, I believe that this team reconnected with what brought them to public service in the first place. And I really believe that if we all work together and embrace the changes we've discussed today, we can similarly reconnect to what brought us here. And equally important, improve our service to the American people. Thank you for your time today.
Jeff has agreed to take a few questions, and what I would ask is if you have questions, there's a mic in the center of the room, and if you could just approach the mic and give us your name and your affiliation before you ask your question, that would be great. So, a lot to digest. Are there questions? This is your chance. Okay, I'm going to tell you a story. Do you know that there are emperor penguins in the Antarctic, and if you watch the nature shows, you'll see them jostling on the ice floes there, and then one of them gets shoved off, and then all the rest like kind of take a little step back. They're waiting to see if the orca actually eats that penguin, and when it doesn't, they all plunge in to the water. So what we need is, who wants to be the first penguin off the iceberg? This is your chance. Questions?
Jeffrey, thanks for the remarks. Excellent job. Anybody that can last 100 days certainly deserves our recognition. How can private industry participate with you in helping you achieve some of the goals that you shared with us today? And how can the folks in this room go back to their private companies and relay that mission to them?
It's a good question. One of the frustrations that I need to figure out how to channel in a positive way toward change are the sort of different walls that exist between engaging all of you and ensuring that you can continue to go about your business. So I was unaware of that, so I naively on the way in assumed that there'd be lots of easy opportunities to gather you and get your best practices and thoughts. So I have to figure out exactly how we do that from an administrative perspective. But that is what I think we need. You have a sense of what's, especially those of you who work across sectors, of what is different about what we're doing, from best practices that you've either seen in other government agencies or in a private sector or state and local, wherever it might be. And we want to absorb those as quickly as we can and learn from those. So I'm not sure what space you're in, but when you go to the VA Disabilities Claim Processing Center in St. Louis, and it's not a cave, but it is a building with metal desks that have folders, manila folders with people's medical records, and they might be that high, and they pass from one desk to the next. And that's really important work, ensuring that our veterans get whatever disability benefits they're entitled to, yet it takes 160-odd days to get through that process on average. So when you think about that process and you think about the private sector, that business, if that had been a business, they would have been out of business 40 years ago. How do we rapidly catch up? How do we not make incremental change, but how do we leapfrog? My wife is actually in Africa. She's South African. And when you go to South Africa, the cell phone coverage is unbelievable. It's unbelievable throughout much of Africa because they basically skipped the whole copper line piece. So glasses half full here is, while we've missed a lot of things, let's see where we can leapfrog really more than just make incremental change, more than catch up. So I would love the idea flow. I need to sort through exactly how we do that in the best way. It obviously maintain legality and your independence and your ability to do business, but we need the ideas, and I think you disproportionately have those ideas because you have the ability, you've seen different sectors of government and sectors beyond government. This penguin thing worked. Yeah. No one wants advice on parenting. You wouldn't want to come here. Please.
Hi, I'm Deborah Decker, and I'm both an associate of Harvard and of Booz Allen Hamilton. And I don't know if you're familiar with the study that we did over a two-year period on what works to affect strategic change in government.
Is this the work that Kelman was involved
right,
in?
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
I have seen that work. It's very good work.
Yeah, and so one of the key things that came out of it, and it's a fabulous presentation, I'm so excited about what you're doing, was just what you're talking about, the need for goal setting within an agency. One of the findings, interestingly enough, was that there's so many people involved in goal setting to get Congress to buy in, to get the president to buy in, to get everybody to buy in on those goals can be sometimes difficult. And interestingly, some of the leaders I spoke with didn't know that they were allowed to so-called lobby. They're not allowed to lobby. But to get those goals agreed to among the general, among media and Congress and all the other stakeholders, are the goals that you've put forward or the agencies have put forward to you, are they, what kind of buy-in, what kind of process did you go through, how vetted were they, and are they online?
They will be online. In the sort of, we're still in the middle of forming those goals, so there's a lot of back and forth. The forcing function or the timetable is the same as the FY 2011 budget, so they'll be developed across the next few months, and once they are settled on, so we had permission from Interior to use that one. Once they're settled on, they'll be made public, and they'll have milestones and the outcomes-based metrics, which we can all track. And we are encouraging agencies to work with congressional leaders on those goals. We are working with Congress on those goals. But it's going to be a multi-year process. I mean, we're just starting a new way of doing this. And I think the most important thing is that we are starting with what the agencies believe should be their priorities rather than centrally trying to tell them what their priorities should be. So it's a learning process, an iterative process, but transparency and openness, I think you are absolutely correct, has to be front and center in this process.
Jeff, I'm interested to know how you go about changing the cultural setting for your staff from the command mm-hmm. and control to the focus within your organization. My name is Will Hayward. I'm from Treasury.
Thank you. Well, I should start with I lucked out here, and I have a really strong group. You know, the statutory offices that I'm responsible include the Financial Management Office, the Procurement Office, the eGov Office, OIRA, which is the Regulatory Office, and then the Performance and Personnel Management Office. I've been struck by how strong this team of people, it's probably 100 or so people, how strong they are and how committed they are. And it's been it was a surprise and also a little bit of a relief because in the private sector I was spoiled by how strong the talent was, and I just didn't know whether it would be equal here, and it's at least equal. So I start off with a really good base. I think they are excited about the change. But we slipped it. Last night we were working on some guidance that's going out to the contracting community across the next week or two, and I could feel the group slipping into some old habits that were much more command and control. So we needed to talk about, is this going to land on people's desks and be viewed as a compliance exercise, or are we providing tools and direction that will enable the strong, committed people throughout the agencies to improve their contracting policy? So we changed it. So I don't think it's all going to happen at once, but I think the group's really excited about it. And we've had some early wins, and we've celebrated those in the same way Gerstner did, if you will. And we have seen how some previously reluctant partners and other parts of government now are asking for our advice or counsel. So it's starting to have some momentum. Again, I think we'll inevitably mess up some, but I think everyone's excited about this direction. So there wasn't a heavy lift for me to convince people that a new direction would be productive. Now I think it's just a matter of building momentum in that direction.
Hello, my name is Jennifer, and I'm from Federal Student Aid. I'm actually relatively new, so I think the whole 150, I really enjoyed that slide about Federal Student Aid, because I just went through that.
How long did it take?
Well, I came into the intern program, so overall it took about 6 months, but I've known my supervisors for about a year, and they really had to push the paper through to get me, you know, as an intern to full-time. So I'm very thankful. I actually just have a quick question. Since this is the Federal Risk Management, Enterprise Risk Management Summit, I was wondering what your view is in terms of the role enterprise risk management has in enhancing performance or engagement.
Well, I think it's twofold. One, you have so much knowledge from looking at risk and studying risk that I believe it's important that you proactively spot where we can do a better job and what systems need to be changed or re-engineered or where our vulnerabilities are. So I think the forward-leaning aspect of it is incredibly important. And at the same time, you need to be paranoid for all of us around where the risks are. So I was with the Inspector Generals yesterday for their awards ceremony, which was great. It's a great group of people. And my message there was keep doing what you're doing. It's incredibly important. But at the same time, and they do this, but do even more proactive reach out as to how can we preempt fraud and abuse? How can we prevent it from happening in the first place? How can we create systems that are just much more effective and much more efficient? So I think this vantage point, this lens of risk is a really important one. And I think that you need to keep doing what you're doing. And if you spot the more proactive things that we can be doing to improve overall effectiveness and efficiency, it's just the same response I had to the first question. We want to hear about that, and we want to get that done.
Anything else? Yes, over here.
Hi, I'm Chris Featherstone from GAO, and I'm going to piggyback a little bit on her question because I'm also somebody that just got hired. I was class of 2009 coming out of undergrad. And I want to know what kind of, I guess, private hiring practices you've seen that maybe the government could adopt to maybe streamline the process a little bit or make it a little bit easier for us to get that really good talent that you've been talking about. And quicker fashion, because I've talked to a lot of my friends who are out of a job and have told them to look into government work, and a lot of them just don't want to deal with the process because they didn't have the advantage I had of being an intern in 2008.
Yes. Well, you know, my number one observation from the private sector, where, again, these two companies that I was involved with, we were lucky enough to grow really fast, Corporate Executive Board and Advisory Board. So we were trying to hire hundreds of people like you straight off of campus every year. And what I kept saying was recruiting is sales. We are competing for the very best talent, and we have to be selling all the time, which means that every interaction that a candidate has with us has to be a sales interaction, meaning we are putting our best foot forward. And whether it's USA Jobs or, which I don't think performs at the level it should, or it's senior-level engagement in hiring. It's almost as if, which, again, if recruiting is sales and you're a private company, your senior-most people are going to your campus to talk about their experience. I don't think a lot of that happens here. It's not just the outreach to campus. It's also, once you're in the process, are senior folks owning that process and pushing it, which sends a signal to the whole organization that recruiting matters, or is that not happening? I don't think it's really happening. Yes.
You know, I was lucky enough to kind of become interested with the GAO because of people that I knew that had worked with them. But that was the only way.
Well, it's a reflection of how passionate you are about serving. Because you clearly had lots of other opportunities to do lots of other things. So you slogged through and got it done through your internship and all the rest. There's actually, Dean Elwood is the dean of the Kennedy School. And he is coordinating a day session on the exact question you just asked, which is, you know, what can we do by examining our own processes like FSA and making changes, which FSA has done, but also what can we learn from the private sector. So, and I think it's the 28th. I'm going to participate along with senior people from Google and Microsoft and other leading-edge private companies in recruiting. With Secretary Donovan, who cares a lot about this at HUD, John Berry, who's leading our efforts at OPM, and it's that question: how can we make this recruiting system work a lot better and fast? And Elwood told the story of one of his star students at the Kennedy School, who had an offer from McKinsey, not Booz Allen, but McKinsey. So that was a mistake already. No, McKinsey's a great firm. But it's great, I mean, to be in their federal government practice. So this woman had a great offer. It was given in, I think, October and of last year. And she would have been, known that for her final year at the Kennedy School, she had a great job. I think she was going to get a signing bonus, all those kind of good things. She decided, and Elwood and others said, that's fantastic, to instead pursue a job, I think it was at the NSC. And come June, her mentors, including Elwood, felt quite bad about the decision that they had coached her on, which was, given your passion, why don't you go directly to the government rather than serve the government through McKinsey, because she still didn't have the job. And she didn't get the job until August, almost a year later. So what a great story about how much she cared and how badly she wanted to be part of the government, but not a great story on, you know, how long it takes us to bring very talented, very committed people in.
Last question? Okay, last question right here.
I'll stick to the recruiting example, and I agree with what everybody's saying. In fact, I'm getting close to retirement, and I thought I'd like to do something for another government agency, and I went out to One Step, and even I wouldn't fill out all that documentation in recruiting One Step. I mean, they ought to call it recruiting 25 Step or something. But a lot of that, because OMB's done a great job of the president management agenda in thing. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say OMB. I meant OPM.
Mm-hmm.
Has done a great job in things like EQIP, eGov, EOPF. But recruiting One Step is really lagged. And in talking to them on why, they have all these rules on you have to prove you haven't discriminated. You have to write 10,000 words on 25 KSIs so that they can show, well, this person wrote a better essay than that person did. So I think a lot of this comes from tone at the top. When we, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, everything else, we talk about tone at the top. And I think there's a tone at the top that doesn't allow agencies to do some of this because you're more worried about, can I prove that I didn't discriminate or can I prove that I didn't do something than you are with the success of whatever it is you're working on. So, you know, I applaud what you're saying, but there's a real tone at the top that has to happen before you're going to see that flow down into the agencies.
100% agree. 100%. And at the end of the day, we are not going to have a recruiting process that has the same degrees of freedom as the private sector has in terms of compensation, for example. I mean, there are systems that are good systems, or principles that need to be incorporated into good systems. So I think tone at the top, absolutely. Other considerations, this is more complex. All that said, should it take 160 days? I think no way. And you should be able to lift up and say, I might want to serve somewhere else and not be intimidated by a cumbersome process, but rather be embraced for what is such a good desire for you to to do other things, and that should be easy, not hard. So is there a counterbalance? Absolutely. It's the same that I talked about in contracting. There are diversity of interest, and there's different things that we need to do. But do I think we've struck the right balance? I don't think so, and I think we should plow through and figure out how to really streamline this and make government service cool again, the way President Obama described it. So I don't want to undermine the challenge. It's not a clean sheet of paper that you can just go ahead and write a 10-day process and be done with it. But you're going to see real changes, and we're very committed to getting it done.